people are participating in globalization. Ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available from iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Philadelphia radio show host Andrea Lawful Saunders resigns after admitting that Biden's campaign fed her questions prior to a July 3rd interview. Is this common media practice, or is this poor, even unethical journalism? We have global journalists Barrington Salmon and John Jeter with us today to discuss. Stay tuned. Good morning and welcome to What's at Stake. My name is Denise Young and I am your host for the second Wednesday edition of the show. WPFW family, brace yourselves. We have another epic conversation for you this morning. Yeah, I know I say that every week and every week I mean it. But before we get to business at hand, I do want to remind our WPFW family to tune in this Thursday special Ellington 125 fundraiser. You can go to the website for those that contribute to our relocation fund, which is what the fundraiser is helping with, and are able to donate $125 or more. A commemorative 125 Ellington thank you gift is there for you. So please go to our website. Okay, so we're going to get to our business. Our guests today are journalists Barrington Salmon and John Jeter. Welcome.
Thank you. How you doing?
I am well. John, how are you? Are you muted?
Sorry.
That's okay.
I'm not awake yet.
It's okay. Thank you both for joining us at What's at Stake this morning, and our listeners will be really engaged this morning. So before we get into the discussion, I always like to invite our guests to tell our WPFW family who they're listening to. So Barrington, why don't you start us off?
Who I'm listening to, like radio like, and all that.
Like you.
Okay. I'm sorry.
I know that's a popular question now. Like, okay. Who's in your iPad? Okay.
I'm still a working journalist. This is my 40th year. Written for about almost two dozen and a half newspapers. Most of my stories focus on the African condition. Problems, issues, concerns of Africans in the diaspora. Still get up in the morning wanting to continue writing. I'm a columnist sometimes, investigative reporter sometimes, more than 15,000 stories, and so it continues.
Well, welcome, Brother Barrington.
Thank you.
John, our listeners, you know, may be familiar with you because you've joined the WPFW What's at Stake show many times. But for those of who may have tuned in and didn't catch you, please tell us, who are you?
I am, like Barrington, I am an old journalist trying to recover. I spent 13 years at the Washington Post, including 5 overseas as the Southern Africa Bureau Chief and a few as the South America Bureau Chief, despite my very, very poor Spanish. And now I'm mostly a book author and huge fan of both Barrington Salmon and Denise Young.
Thanks,
well, we appreciate that, brother. So let me also just say that when I first thought to do this story, it was, actually at the prompt of another journalist who blasted his take on it on Twitter, now X, and because I hadn't heard about it yet. And I actually invited this brother, Torin Walker, who wanted to also be part of this discussion, but is traveling. So I do want to at least say thank you to him for, considering, because he was checking his schedule and was like, oh, I can't do it because, my layover is just until this time. And so was even willing to do it from the airport. So I just wanted to make that known. And so in addition to that, when I thought of, okay, we got to talk about this story, I really had to sit and think about who I thought would be able to really engage in a way that our audience could really appreciate it. Because this is really a story, largely, although there are, far-reaching implications, this is really about the ethics of journalism. Or am I off base with that?
No, you're right. You're right.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the relationship, the evolving relationship between the media and government, and particularly Black media and government. And so, yeah, I think you're right. It is about ethics and also just, even deeper, the relationship, how we're going to forge a relationship, how we're going to remake the relationship going ahead, going forward.
Yeah, and the thing that I think about is that I'm pretty sure that this young lady agreed to what they wanted because she was hoping to have continued access to the president. And everything, just about everything that journalists, particularly Washington journalists, do is with having continued access in mind. So they'll sometimes bend, sometimes move the rules or the norms that govern how they deal with these people in order to, I guess, stay relevant. Because it was a big deal from what I read that this lady got the first interview after his debate.
Yes.
But yes. I read several stories last night, and one of the things that struck me was that she said she told the management that she's not a journalist, and they hired her because of her skills as a talk show host. So if that is true, then it kind of changes what she did.
Oh, okay.
If she was a straight journalist like John or I, because the whole idea, I have had people who have suggested questions that I should use, mm-hmm. as a proud woman, would never use their questions. I'm gonna riff off of the questions they gave me, or mm-hmm. take it in a whole different direction, because for me, a part of that whole thing is integrity.
Yes.
So,
okay. So before we continue, what I'd like to do, just to help our audience get up to speed, in case they haven't been on X or haven't seen any clips, I'm actually going to play a clip from an interview that she gave with Victor Blackwell of First of All with CNN on July 6th.
There's something that's similar here. You each were, you asked four questions, and maybe that's what you were allowed to ask by the campaign or the White House. But they were essentially the same questions, both interviews, about accomplishments, progress in your respective state, what's at stake in the election, what he has to say about his debate performance, and what he would say to voters who think their vote doesn't matter or might sit this election out. Were those questions given to you by the White House, or did you have, or the campaign, or did you have to submit questions ahead of this interview?
The questions were sent to me for approval. I approved them.
Okay, so the White House sent the questions to you ahead of the interview?
Yes.
Okay.
I got several questions, eight of them, and the four that were chosen were the ones that I approved.
Okay. And the reason I ask is not a criticism of either of you. It's just that if the White House is trying now to prove the vim, vigor, acuity of the president, I don't know how they do that by sending questions first before the interview so that the president knows what's coming.
Okay. So what's not completely evident and on audio is that there are actually two people that Victor Blackwell was interviewing.
Yeah.
And the second person is Earl Ingram of the Earl Ingram Show in Wisconsin. And so the reference to, you know, the same questions is that he's interviewing both people, even though you do not hear anything from Mr. Ingram in terms of a response in that clip. He's being discussed because, or they're brought together because both of them had these early interviews after the debate, but also, as Victor Blackwell mentioned, hey, listen, wait a minute, this is it coincidence? Did you guys talk on the phone the night before interviews and bounce ideas off of each other? Like, how did it happen that there were four particular questions that you guys seem to have had in common? And so I think that what we, you know, as listeners, I think for me, I was trying to understand, like, as you, and you talked a little bit about this earlier, Barrington, but at any time, is there a concern or a thought, one, about what you said in terms of integrity, but also this idea of sort of being boxed in? Because I know that if I had the opportunity, if, you know, little old Denise LaShawn Young from South Side of Chicago had an opportunity to ask Biden some questions, I promise you that none of my questions would be on his list. If he had a list of 20 questions, my first question would not be number 21.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's a stupid move given the firestorm around his poor debate performance and the constant hammering about his age and his cognitive skills and all of that. As I'm not a consultant or an analyst or anything, but it would have made sense to me to put him in a situation where you get a sense of the scope of questions he's going to ask, and let the people just ask questions and he answer them. I can't think of a better way to show that he's got a grip, that he's able to interact, to relate, and all that stuff. And so somebody dropped the ball.
John?
Yeah, no, I agree with Barrington. I think it was a lapse in judgment, although I think that the radio station in Philadelphia, at least, is complicit in this. I think the woman, the young woman who was hired to do this interview, she was doing what she thought she was supposed to do. I do understand, though, that one of the questions that the Biden camp proposed was, what is Joe Biden's, how has he helped the Black community, or something to that effect, which I think is a good question, I would have accepted if I was her. I did not hear the interview, so I don't know if she was effective in this interview or not. But I think she's the fall guy for this radio station, this Philadelphia radio station. She's not a trained journalist, as Barrington said, and they just they didn't set the guardrails for this interview, and so she kind of just fell back on instinct as a talk show host, ready, you know, not a trained journalist. I just think that it speaks to journalism's evolving role, right? If she was trying to serve the community by asking Joe Biden, really trying to drill down and hold Joe Biden accountable, for the last 4 years or the last 40 years, really, as a public servant, then I don't think this would be an issue, right? She would have certainly had a different approach, and you know, maybe she would still accepted one or two questions. Who knows? And that would have been fine. But the bigger issue is, you know, are you trying to serve the people, or are you trying to, as Barrington suggested, trying to gain access? Are you trying to be like the white reporters who have access, right? Is that really the holy grail for you, having access? Because you know, the difference between those two approaches means everything in the quality of the journalism.
For sure, for sure. John is absolutely correct.
Is this now? Obviously, with both, I'm gonna say journalists for the you know, for the purpose of the conversation. When we are looking at both these journalists, both of them are Black. Would anyone be able to say, particularly because one has resigned, there was a parting of the ways. At this point, Ingram still is employed. Would we be able to discuss this as an issue of race or racism? I mean, because I think that anytime politically, you know, whenever you have Black people involved, you don't need to have a banner that says this is racism in order for it to be racism or racist. But I'm wondering if racism is a dynamic in this, and if so, how so? And how should we in our community be discussing this or even looking at this?
I don't think I wouldn't see it as purely racist. Mm-hmm. It's racial. From my perspective, if you look at the big picture, I think it would be wise for us to look at the dynamics that have existed between Black media and the people that they cover. One of the biggest complaints that that Black newspapers have had for most of the time that I've been writing is that during primaries and elections and all that stuff, most of the time they don't get media money. They don't, you know, and I've heard clips of white consultants and politicians saying that they see no need to spend money in the Black community because Black people are going to vote for Democrats anyway. Mm-hmm. So I see it as racial, but not necessarily racist. But, you know, in America, everything is race. So.
John, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Barrington. I see it as racial. And it speaks to this question. You know, white supremacy in the United States has survived because it has managed to peel off layer after layer of people who could express solidarity with Black people, but instead choose to be white or white adjacent, right? It was the Irish and it was the Italians. It was women. Now they're trying to claim Latinos and offer Latinos a chance to be honorary whites, right? You won't live like white people, but you'll live better than Black people. And we'll see what happens with that. But even Black people are offered, right? The Black elite, Black journalists, Black politicians are offered this opportunity to be white adjacent, to be part of the club, to distance themselves from the Black working class. And we see that even not just with the media, but with all Black institutions. Just this week, I think the president had a Zoom call with members of the Congressional Black Caucus and said, you know, hey, if you guys got my back, I'll continue to have your back. Well, the question should be, how have you had our back, right? You've done nothing for the Black community. But they just sort of cheered him on. They didn't negotiate. Pardon me. They didn't negotiate anything on behalf of the Black community. and this is really the point, I think, right? Like, it's racial in that this these two radio hosts, I assume, without having heard their interviews, you know, this was an opportunity to be part of the club, to have access to Joe Biden, like the white reporters. But at the same time, if you do that, you forfeit your ability to serve the black community. And this is like the big problem, right? Is what does it mean to be an African in America in 2024? That's what we're really dealing with here, right? I think we talked briefly yesterday, Denise, and I talked about how people kind of forget that Malcolm X got his start, at least in public life, as a journalist. He is the one who created Muhammad Speaks for the Nation of Islam, and that became a huge organizing tool. I think the way that Malcolm X saw himself as a journalist, and he wasn't a classically trained journalist, although I would argue he is the greatest intellectual this country has ever produced. You know, he saw journalism as a tool to serve the people. I think we need to get back to that and try to figure out what that means in 2024. And this is where I think we really fell short with this issue that we're talking about in this relationship between these journalists, black journalists, and the White House. How are we serving the people by letting them frame the narrative for us? At least I assume that's the case. Again, I didn't hear the interview, but how are we serving the people if we let the White House frame the narrative? Because this is not just some casual talk, right? This is about our government, our rule, and it's about the end of empire. Like, how are we going to forge a way ahead at the end of empire? This thing is starting to collapse on us. Everyone's starting to see that. That's what this election is about. And we have two parties, both the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, Donald Trump is not immensely popular in the United States. He's just more popular with his base than Joe Biden is with his, right? It's a battle of attrition. So, you know, and Denise, I think you will appreciate this as a child of the South Side of Chicago. We need to have a conversation about Harold Washington and how he got elected in 1983 as the first black mayor of a city that was not predominantly black, right? We need to have that conversation. Why did they make that move? How did the black community in Chicago in 1982, how did they elevate that conversation? And lastly, I'll say this, and the person who led that process was a black journalist named Lou Palmer, right? And, you know, Barrington has heard this. I'm not sure if you have, Denise, but Barrington has heard the question, are you a journalist first or are you black first? Yeah. Lou Palmer would laugh at anybody who asked him that question. Mm-hmm. What do you see when you look at me? You see a black man, right? I mean, he thought that question was foolish. And in fact, if a black journalist asked it, he wouldn't even work with him. He would dismiss him out of hand. So I think we need to get back to this conversation about the role of the African in the Americas, and as an offshoot of that, what is the role of the black journalist in America? I think we've kind of lost our way. We need people like Barrington and you, Denise, in leadership positions to get us back on track.
I chuckle, and the only reason I chuckle is because I do remember now. You know, I'm in high school at the time, so I'm dating myself a little bit. But when that question was posed, and I just remember thinking, "Well, isn't the answer obvious?" And I didn't really understand even how, as black people, we ever decide or separate our blackness from whatever it is that we're doing. And it's not for the purpose of being able to, you know, wear a label or, you know, to be able to, or even conversely, you know, trying to get away from the label. But I do think it is very important, as both you and Barrington are saying, is that it is very important to understand that our role as, you know, living in America under, as you like to say, John and Barrington, I know, you know, this white settler project. Like we have, it's a way of us really proclaiming our solidarity with one another, our commitment, almost a covenant, right? Our covenant with each other. Right. And that's so right. The moment that we break it is when we really get into trouble. And so I feel like, unfortunately, that, you know, both Lawful Sanders and Ingram may have put themselves in that position of and not necessarily meaning to, you know, but I think we do. I think we have these expectations that, you know, this proximity or adjacency and all of those things are going to provide us with some things, and we see time and time again that what we get in return becomes something that creates a bigger wedge between us and one another, or this chasm within our community. So we are going to be going to break in about 5 minutes. I just wanted to make sure that I announced that, because I know that these conversations can get really in depth. But I want to pivot just a little bit and talk more about this notion of not just media, because we know that media across the country, maybe even across the world, is not living up to its mandate of talking to the people, getting in front of the people and asking them, what is your story? Gift me with your story, right? We know that every day. But particularly with Black people in this country, people who are signing up as journalists, people who are studying to become journalists, are we in a unique position because of being Black that we somehow are feeling the pressure that in order for us to serve our people, we have to, you know, really assume that position of adjacency? And I think what I'm trying to say, without just coming right out and saying, has Black journalism failed the Black community?
I would say yes, because they're trying to serve two masters. So many times that I worked at white publications, it was always this clash, because I remember in particular this newspaper that I worked for in Washington, it was always a fight to present and have them accept stories that was outside of the criminality and outside of the more dour aspects of what the stereotypes, the lazy stereotypes that they have of Black people. And I mean, I remember one time I happened to be passing some photo editors, and it may have been a story I wrote, because I was a crime reporter for a while. And they had a picture, big picture, of somebody, a Black man's hands in handcuffs. And that was a picture that they were going to put accompany the story. And I lost my mind. And we had a long back and forth, and to their credit, they understood when I finished that, you know, that's their perspective of who we are, and that is a tiny part of the totality of who we are as African people in America. You asked if it's unique. I think that we're in a unique position, because as John rightly said, this is the end of empire. Everything is shattering. Mm-hmm. 10,000 journalists lost their jobs last year. Every day you read the paper, they're laying off people. Hedge funds are buying newspapers and selling off the newspapers for parts. They don't need journalists. There's an AI challenge and all this type of stuff. So what would seem like doom and gloom to most people, I see as an opportunity for those with some creativity and innovation to figure out new ways to do their job. If your mission is to serve Black people, there are lots of ways to do that. It's harder because a lot of times money is hard to come by, but it's not impossible.
Okay. Well, with that, we're going to take a break. You're listening to What's at Stake on WPFW, and we'll be right back after the station break.
Born in 1899, Edward Kennedy Ellington ranks as the greatest all-around musical figure. This Thursday, July 11th, from midnight until midnight, WPFW honors Ellington on the occasion of his 125th birth year with Ellington 125, a celebration beyond category. Hi, this is Miyuki. WPFW must move, so we will be raising funds toward that end. Our goal is $15,000, and there are Ellington 125 commemorative gifts available as a thank you gift for your support. You can donate now or anytime on our website. For those that contribute to our relocation fund and are able to donate $125 or more, a special commemorative 125 Ellington thank you gift is described on our website. Help WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Welcome back to What's at Stake on WPFW. I'm Denise Young, and we are here with Barrington Salmon and John Jeter discussing the journalistic faux pas that is causing heated debates. So when we left off, Barrington, you were talking about really, you know, having particularly, specifically, Black journalists looking to be creative and innovative, and I'm assuming also recommitting themselves to this covenant of journalism and what it means to be a storyteller of the people and really holding sacred our narratives. I want to pivot just a little bit, because one of the things that struck me, and both you and John have said this morning, but part of the telling of the narrative, or holding our narrative sacred and responding to the covenant, would have been really pressing the Biden camp, that and not just these two talk show hosts, but all of our Black media, really pressing, and actually, and not even just our Black media, but as John said, our Black caucus, to be able to really press and say, listen, this relationship has not been fruitful, and so when we as we are continuing to get closer to election, one thing that it's not lost on me that you have two Black journalists or two radio hosts who get an interview, which I thought was particularly interesting. You know, one of the first, and actually Lawful Sanders got the first after the debate. So, as we continue to move forward, what should we be talking about in our community? What in terms of, as we look at Biden and this relationship, this political relationship, what should we be talking about? What should we be measuring? What should we be expecting moving forward as we see more debates, as we get closer to the election, what do we what should these analysts and, you know, the Eddie Glauds and all of those people who are in a position behind desks, what should they be talking about?
If I may, to piggyback off what Barrington was just saying, I really think that the role of the Black journalist is to understand we are a community apart. Ours is a community apart. Blacks are not like everyone else. And I don't mean to say that we're better, but we are the super exploited class of the working class in the United States. And at the same time, we are the most progressive political bloc in the country. And we have been since before slavery ended, right? Mm-hmm. And we need to realize that we have this historical role. Again, back to Harold Washington, who said exactly this. We have a historical role in the United States as a leadership, as the vanguard of the working class. And what we have seen, you know, it's funny. One of the first stories that I remember reading as a young man in Indianapolis growing up, one of the first stories that made news sort of just for the story was the Washington Post publication in 1980 of a story about an 8-year-old Black heroin addict written by a Black woman named Janet Cook. Mm-hmm. And the story was fabricated, completely made up. And it was a story that the top Post editors, the legendary Ben Bradley and the legendary Bob Woodward, they really wanted the story. And so the Black reporters who were there, all of them, to a woman, said, this story is not true. It was sitting in the computer for weeks before they published it. And it went on to win a Pulitzer. And they said, this story is not true. And even if it was true, this woman who wrote it, who had distanced herself from the Blacks in the newsroom, she could not have produced it. There's no way she could go into this community and talk to these people and get this story, bring the story back. So, of course, they were right. It turned out not to be true. Mm-hmm. And the Washington Post had this tremendous egg on its face. He had to give back the Pulitzer. But the question really is, why did she pick? She was trying to get her ticket punched and she almost succeeded. But the question is, why did she choose that story? Mm-hmm. A story about an 8-year-old Black heroin addict. Well, the reason, if you think about it, 1980, Ronald Reagan is coming into office. Mm-hmm. The Washington Post is trying to keep its profit. They were already making money hand over fist, but they want to keep those profit margins really, you know, at the top, because they had just gone public a few years earlier. And so this narrative was commercialized, this narrative, because it showed Black people as unfit for public life, right? Which is what Ronald Reagan's presidency was all about, right? It was, you know, don't trust those Black people who are telling you you should go on strike, who are in your unions, right? This is what Ronald Reagan was all about. This is what Bill Clinton was all about. And subsequently, the last 40 years have been about marginalizing the Black voice, which is the most progressive voice in the country. Now, I say all that to say that if you realize that as a journalist, what would your goal be? Well, your goal would be, and let's just keep it on the south side of Chicago. I guess it's the west side, actually. Your goal should be, as Fred Hampton said, right? You need to recognize we're from the valley. Right? Black people, we from the valley, right? But there's a mother sucker who's playing king on a mountaintop. So we got to go to the mountaintop at some point and we got to let them know, yo, we from the valley, right? So I saw that to say, not to be funny, not to be glib about it really, right? But if you have that understanding of who we are and the role that we play, then what would have happened with this Joe Biden interview would have been different. If only because you would have been channeling the people, right? As Frederick Douglass said, if we are to be saved, it will be by the crew, not the captain, right? They had channeled the voices of the people, the Black community, this super exploited class, this vanguard of the revolution historically, that would have been a different kind of, and I didn't hear it, right? But I'm just going on what I've heard, what I hear in the media every day. It's a very different conversation if you're channeling the voices of those people from the valley, right? And you're the interlocutor between the people from the valley and that king the guy who's playing king on a mountaintop. That's a very different conversation. Whether it's Joe Biden in office, whether it's Donald Trump in office, whether it's Barack Obama in office, that's a very different conversation. And what I might say, and I'm going to shut up and let Barrington say something because he's much smarter than me, it's a conversation that is useful and democratic.
Yes.
You asked a question about what should we be writing about?
Yeah.
We need to be writing about a whole bunch of stuff. Starting with, I think since the Orange Menace came into office, it has accelerated the dismantling of social systems. I thank Taraji P. Henson every day. She came on the BET Awards on the 30th of June, mm-hmm. and she stopped to talk about Project 2025, which everybody should know about. That's a 920-page blueprint created by the Heritage Foundation of what a conservative Republican, it doesn't have to be Trump.
Right.
Republican president and administration would put in place. And the ones who are going to be most affected, as always, are the canaries in the coal mine. Mm-hmm. African people in this country. They are talking about completely dismantling diversity, equity, and inclusion. They're talking about making sure that no federal institution has any data that shows discrimination. Trump said the first thing he's going to do when he gets in is begin mass arrests and raids, picking up as many as 20 million undocumented immigrants and deporting them. We as Black people should be talking about that, but we should also be talking about the effects of what these guys are doing. They're stealing, they're using gerrymandering and redistricting to steal votes. It looks like a total retrenchment. They are trying to erase the 20th century. They want to make sure that they want to put women back in the kitchen. They want to make sure that all of the rights, voting rights, civil rights, employment opportunities and access, that all these things are pulled down so that Blacks have no place to go. I guess maybe they want to put us back on a plantation or something.
Well, I think that that's true. I guess the question that I would ask, and I would, and then again, this is what I mean by, my 21st question, or my first question wouldn't have been number 21 on that list, but Biden and the Democratic Party knew that this Project 25 document existed before we got it into conversation at the BET Awards, right? So, and evidence of it is when they began to, so I guess what, it's been what, 2 years, 3 years, maybe a little bit longer, where I have to measure everything now against the pandemic, but we're looking at about 4 years where they've been talking about dismantling, not just talking about it, but going after critical race theory, which is so significant. First of all, just undoing the work of Dr. Derrick Bell, God rest his soul, and the brilliance behind coming up, he wasn't just Dr. Bell, but others, these really incredible minds who understood that there is this thread that is running through all of our systems. And because this thread of racism is running through our systems, there's always going to be this dynamic where Black people are going to be exploited even without anyone actually going in and purposely trying to exploit us, because the systems are set up that way. And so if you now have a group, you know, the Heritage Foundation and all of these Republicans, and they're saying, okay, here's the evidence, because that's essentially what it is. Here's the evidence, and we have to get rid of it. We have to poke holes in it. And so you start with critical race theory, and then you have people at Board of Education meetings crying and whining about little Johnny can't sit in the classroom because I don't want him to feel bad, because and we shouldn't be teaching critical race theory in the public schools. Well, first of all, nobody is teaching critical race theory in the public schools. And so this conversation continued. It is continuing if we look at what's happening specifically in Florida, where you get to opt out of just even Black History Month festivities or events. So I guess my question, and I agree with you completely, Barrington, all of those things we should be talking about. But if I'm going back to, you know, being a radio show host who had the opportunity to talk to Biden, why didn't that question, why was that question not posed? Like, why are we not continuously asking this administration, you know, the hard questions?
We're afraid to offend Massa.
Yeah.
Okay, well, well, there's that. There's definitely that.
Yeah, we're too concerned with the white gaze. What that allows is that people who mean us harm, not all white people, but certainly many of them, and really critical actors like Wall Street, like the people on Capitol Hill, they're allowed to frame the debate. And so, you know, we talk about critical race theory, or they talk about critical race theory, and we repeat it a lot of times, and we don't understand that everything that critical race theory espouses, or most of it anyway, is true. There are these systems of oppression. And as a Black city councilman, actually county councilman, told me the night that Bill Clinton was elected and Detroit City Hall, before the internet, we had to actually watch TV to see who won. And Bill Clinton had won. And this Black county councilman, I can say his name, I don't think he would mind, Arthur Blackwell. He said to me after everybody had high-fived each other, you know, mostly Black people, Detroit. And he said to me, you know, yeah, but it don't really matter. You know, he said the president can be Democrat or Republican. He can be Black or white. Wall Street can go up 500 points or down 500 points. Negroes are still poor. And he didn't say Negroes. Right. And I found that to be almost like the most prophetic statement I have ever heard. We are still poor. And yet we don't have this conversation. The media is not having this conversation, you know. With Joe Biden, one of the questions I wish they had asked, maybe they did, I don't know. Again, I didn't see the interview, but I doubt they asked it. Why is it that, you know, 4 years after George Floyd was murdered on camera, lynched on camera, ain't nothing changed? In fact, I think it was just a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago now, a Black man in Milwaukee was, the same thing was done to him on camera, by hotel security staff, right? I think he was having maybe a mental episode, and they killed him. He didn't hurt anybody. He didn't have a gun or anything like that. So we need to have these conversations, right? We need to scratch where we itch, if I can get Southern for a second. And we need to explore why, just exactly why are we this super exploited class? Or, and I'll end on this, as James Baldwin would say, I'll be your N-word, but can you explain to me why you need one?
Right.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. I think a critical question that all of us as Africans in America need to ask ourselves is whether or not we plan to continue to be a part of this system or break completely. I don't know what that looks like fully, but I do know that in 1967, Reverend Martin Luther King was lamenting that he had been instrumental in bringing integration. Mm-hmm. And he said, I am afraid that I'm bringing my people into a burning building. And that was 1967. Mm-hmm. And the fire continues. I always think about Mimi and I went to a conversation with a dude, Dr. Jonathan Metzler, He's a professional.
And for our WPFW family, Mimi is Mr. Barrington's lovely wife.
Yeah. And he had spent 7 years going across the country.
Oh, right.
Talking to white people.
Dying to be white, right?
Dying to be white. Wrote a book, yeah. Dying to be White. He interviewed between 1,500 and Dying for Whiteness. And interviewed between 1,500 and 2,000 white people. And the theme from rich, poor, middle class, trailer park trash was that they do not believe. They vehemently oppose the idea of blacks, Latinos, undocumented immigrants having access to quality housing, education, or the things that they consider to only be for good Americans.
Yes.
We have not, as a group of people, ever confronted this issue in a way that I think would allow us to have some options and also have some plans.
Yes.
Because they've made it clear. And all of this stuff that we're seeing with the MAGA and his base and the orange menace just tapping into this grievance. Now, I mean, I understand, because at the end of the day, what John and I have talked about, what Fred Hampton and many of these other folks, these activists have talked about, is the need for us to come together as a group, black, white, brown, whatever, because all of us are being exploited by the oligarchs, by the politicians. I mean, there's no difference. There's no real difference between Democrats and Republicans. In substance, there is, but Democrats are weak. They're feckless. I believe, you know, it's funny because the other day I was thinking to myself, God damn, I'm looking and seeing, anybody who has half a mind can see the potential damage that will happen to us primarily if Republicans are given the keys to the kingdom again. Democrats aren't doing anything. Democrats as a whole, they're not doing anything except wringing their hands and saying, vote for us because Trump is a demon.
Right.
That's not enough.
That's not enough.
We never demand anything. We don't go to these people and tell them, if you don't give us X, Y, Z, 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 we ain't voting for you. We don't do that. We sit down, our so-called civil rights leaders go to Washington and listen to Joe Biden tell them that if they don't vote for him, they ain't really black.
Right, right.
Nobody said anything because they don't want to offend nobody.
And then they bring that message back to the community, and then we're repeating it.
But the problem too is that the people who are our quote unquote leaders need to step aside because they've been in control, in quotes, too long. We need young people. We need young energy. We need a different type of thinking, because none of this stuff works. As John said, quoting the gentleman, we still poor. We're still at the bottom of the totem pole. I mean, look at the Fearless Fund.
Right.
I think her name is Ariane Simone, and her colleague, they were given $20,000 and $30,000 grants in a venture capital world where 0.39% of all of the money that goes to venture capital goes to black women led firms. Uh-huh. And that, let me not say what I want to say. Edward Blum sued, and the appeals court said that they can't do it because they're supposed to be giving white men money too.
Right, right.
So I think it is clear. I mean, nobody at this point can say that they don't know. The courts aren't for us. The politicians aren't for us. There's nothing for us. As Dr. John Hendrick Clark said, African-Americans have no friends.
No friends.
Yeah.
So we got to contend with that before we do anything else. But we're afraid. We're afraid. Because I talked to people and I said to them, as you see what's coming, what are you doing? Do you have a plan B? They start hyperventilated.
Right. And yeah, and this is the time, and I have to go back to an interview that I did a few weeks ago Dr. Shockley, who said we have to build. And on that note, we're going to part. Thank you, Barrington and John, for joining us. What's at Stake listeners, thank you for joining us this morning. Thanks to executive producer Ms. Verna Avery Brown. This program is engineered by Mr. Michael Nasella. I'm Denise Young. May we continue to be truth and justice seekers. And stay tuned for our next show, Wake Up and Stay Woke with Dr. E. Faye Williams.
Born in 1899, Edward Kennedy Ellington ranks as the greatest all-around musical figure. This Thursday, July 11th, from midnight until midnight, WPFW honors Ellington on the occasion of his 125th birth year with Ellington 125, a celebration beyond category. Hi, this is Miyuki. WPFW must move, so we will be raising funds toward that end. Our goal is $15,000, and there are Ellington 125 commemorative gifts available as a thank you gift for your support. You can donate now or anytime on our website. For those that contribute to our relocation fund and are able to donate $125 or more, a special commemorative 125 Ellington thank you gift is described on our website. Help WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Code Pink, Women for Peace, is coming to you live from Washington, D.C. and New York City, Thursday at 11 a.m. Code Pink Radio is an energizing new program focused on ending wars and militarism and building a peace economy. Listen weekly to robust conversation and inspiration from grassroots peacemakers from places like Korea, Yemen, Venezuela, Palestine, and Iran, as well as peacemakers in our nation's capital who are confronting war hawks in the White House and in Congress and modeling the actions we want our government to take. Again, that's Code Pink Radio, Thursdays at 11 a.m. on Washington, D.C.'s WPFW and New York City's WBAI, an engaging hour of cutting-edge conversation not to be missed.
We are women of the world. We're from the east, south, north, and west.
PACA, Pan-African Community Action, will be holding the Community Town Hall, The Harm of Crime Bills, and the Future of Community Power in Chaka City. On Saturday, July 13th, from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., D.C. residents are invited to discuss how the Secure D.C. Crime Bill targets the black working class and criminalizes our youth, and how to develop real people-centered solutions to community safety. There will be speakers, group exercises, lunch, and a performance by the Afro-Go-Go Roots Collective, Crank Lukongo Unplugged. The Harm of Crime Bills and the Future of Community Power in Chocolate City, Saturday, July 13th, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the RISE Demonstration Center, 2730 Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, Southeast D.C. More information and registration can be found online, PACA, that's P-A-C-A, crimebilltownhall.eventbrite.com. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, everybody. I'm Melba Moore. Please listen and support your jazz and justice station, WPFW 89.3 FM. Let's all try to listen more.
Yeah. Come on, come on, come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Come on.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east. Yeah.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
To the east, my brother, to the east.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of D.C. communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for jazz and justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings, here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's...